Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. Tough topic, but a great topic, an important topic to cover today. We're going to talk with scholars and experts in the area. One of the key buzzwords right now that we hear a lot in media, in mass media and social media, in legislation as well, laws and policies being passed regarding the transgender issue. We're going to talk about that, particularly when it comes to children and youth. We'll talk about that with experts from the American College of Pediatricians, the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, and a professor of practical theology here at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Hope you can stick around for the conversation. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting this program here on Faith and Family, here on Worldwide KFUO. You can find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin on our website, kfuo.org. Look for the CUW logo in the sponsor section. There you can find more information about Concordia University, Wisconsin, and the great work that they're doing and the opportunities that they make available all around the country. Joining us by phone now, Dr. Michelle Critella, MD and President of the American College of Pediatricians. Dr. Critella, welcome back to Faith and Family.
Andy, thank you so much. It's great to be back.
Glad to have a chance to talk with you today about this very important topic, and looking forward to digging into really what is at the heart of this matter. So looking forward to it. Joining us by phone now, also Dr. Jane Orient. She is the Executive Director of the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons. Dr. Orient, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thanks for the opportunity to discuss this with you.
Very grateful for your time and expertise and knowledge in joining us in the conversation today. And returning to Faith and Family, the Reverend Dr. Bob Weiss. He's Professor of Practical Theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Dr. Weiss, welcome back to Faith and Family.
Oh, thanks to you and your guests for inviting me to participate in this discussion. I appreciate the time.
Absolutely, and I always enjoy our conversations regarding ethics and all the insights that you bring to it and the expertise you bring. So I think we're in for a lot of learning today, a lot of good discussion as well. Before we get too far into the conversation, I'd like to talk about each of you and your background and your education and what that contributes to the conversation today. Dr. Critella, we've talked numerous times here on Faith and Family as a part of the American College of Pediatricians and serving as a pediatrician. Share with us just a little bit about why caring for children is important to you and a little bit about what led up to your profession.
Oh, certainly. I have always had a love and wonder for children. They are just so resilient. And as I went through my training at the University of Connecticut Medical School, I found that they were just the most fun patients to be around, and quite frankly, and that led to my selecting pediatrics for my residency and training. I trained at the Connecticut Children's Medical Center in the late 90s. And was a pediatrician, a general pediatrician in private practice for about 17 years in Rhode Island and Connecticut, and then chose to work full-time with the American College of Pediatricians so that I could be home with my own four children who now range in age from 11 through 18. Our 11-year-old is our daughter, and we have three sons, 12, 15, and 18. During my time in practice, I had a focus on adolescent mental health and as well as adolescent sexual health. And that is really what led to those areas being my concern in terms of wanting to influence parents and society at large. To really have a good knowledge of what's in the best interest of children so that they can have healthy lives, not just through childhood, but as adults.
Thank you very much. And it always does. It always shows in our conversations when we talk about the issues that the American College of Pediatricians brings up as well, and this certainly is one of those. Dr. Orient, tell us a little bit about your background and serving as Executive Director of the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons.
I'd always wanted to be a physician, and I went into general internal medicine. I never really found a specialty that I thought was better than another. I don't see very many children. I was a VA doctor for about 5 years, and I've been in solo private practice since about 1981. I have seen some children, quite a few adolescents, but all patients from all areas of adult medicine. And certainly it is very apparent how much the childhood development affects the person's life as an adult. Certainly sexually transmitted diseases or just other types of disorders that are related to a person's sexuality have an impact in all areas of the person's health. The Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, I've been involved with since I went into private practice. I've been the executive director since about 89, and we stand strongly for the rights of physicians to practice according to their conscience. The Oath of Hippocrates, which says that the physician will treat patients according to the best of his ability and judgment and not do harm. And you'd be amazed to see all of these ersatz, substitute oaths, or additions of the Oath of Hippocrates leave out that part about doing no harm.
Hmm. Well, thank you for your work with the American Association and helping us address this topic today. Dr. Weiss, regular guest here on His Time and on Faith and Family, addressing topics in ethics. You're a professor of practical theology at Concordia Seminary with a unique background. Tell us a little bit more about your education, what led up to your profession today.
Okay, well, I'm a post-hole digger, not an MD. I have a daughter, a brother, son-in-law that are physicians, and range from internal medicine, geriatrics, to OBGYN, to sports medicine. And my wife and I have been married for 46 years, and we have five daughters and seven grandchildren. And most of those are, again, women with two grandsons. So I'm surrounded by women. And so the only thing we don't have in our family, we have lots of PhDs and other things, and we don't have a dentist. But be that as it may, I do have three brothers, older brother that's a physician up in Chicago, myself. My youngest brother has a doctor's degree in theology. He's a pastor in Decatur, Illinois, Lutheran pastor. And my oldest brother is just retired from running a Freightliner company in Memphis, Tennessee. My background is I got my PhD at the University of Illinois in 1972. I was in the Department of Biology and Zoology, studied veterinary hematology, and then went on for a postdoc at Kansas State University in genetics and cell biology, and then taught at Wayne State University School of Medicine in clinical hematology from 73 up through 79. And I was, well, I started in 72, I'm sorry. And then retired or quit my position there as an associate professor and came to the seminary, got my MDiv degree, was a pastor for 10 years. Had three calls to the seminary for this endowed chair with St. Luke Lutheran Charities, Chair of Pastoral Ministry and the Life Sciences. So I've been there since 1992. I officially retired and was given the title of Senior Professor Emeritus, but I still teach. So, you know, and this whole area, I'm currently writing a chapter for a book on human sexuality, on transgender identity in light of biblical identity. And so this of course, is a very difficult topic. There's a ton of stuff out there written on this. It exponentially has really risen since the mid-90s. And the Wall Street Journal, I'm sure the physicians are aware of this, but in Tuesday's paper, the Wall Street Journal, that is Tuesday, January 5th, there was an article on the transgender battle line for childhood relating to prepubescent children. So I'm looking forward to learning from these doctors and other discussions that we have on this topic.
Well, let's get, thank you, Dr. Weiss. Let's get right into the topic of the issue surrounding the topic of transgender, what this means for children, for parents, for schools, and for physicians as well, and what's going to be best for children as we discuss this topic. The first question, what is the difference between sex and gender? Both of those are important topics when it comes to this topic of transgender, but what is the difference, Dr. Cretella, between sex and gender?
You know, that is a critical question. And what people really have to realize is that gender was a term, it's a word that was invented out of thin air. Basically, gender was invented to mean it's a person's awareness of being, feeling female or feeling male. And I say invented because the person who came up, who coined the term, was a cross-dressing male who went by the name of Virginia Prince. And he was not a scientist. Okay, gender is not something that is found in your DNA. It's not something that's found in your brain. It's an abstract, it's a concept, it's an awareness. It's what you think of yourself.
Dr. Orient, how would you describe the difference between sex and gender?
Sex is clearly defined by your chromosomes. If you have a Y chromosome, you're a male. If you don't, you're a female, and there are a few aberrations. There are some people who have endocrine disorders or disordered receptors so that the normal Y chromosome can't express itself properly, and these are very difficult cases. They're emergency both from the medical standpoint and the sociological standpoint, but these are very rare. The gender that we're talking about now is, as Dr. Cretella said, an artificial construct. I used to think it was just had to do with grammar. It's what article adjective you used. But now it seems to have to do with a person's concept about himself, which puzzles me because in reality, there's no way a woman can imagine what it would be like to be a man. You can see how men are treated. You can see how they act. But how can you ever know how any other human being really feels? It's purely your concept or your imagination about what it would be like. And I think that this must almost always have input from the outside, that someone else is contributing to this person's confusion about what his or her identity actually is.
Dr. Weiss, what is the difference between sex and gender in your from your perspective?
Well, certainly from the theological viewpoint, both physicians, both doctors have explained this already, and clearly the Creator created male and female. In Hebrew, that's ish and isha, so that's the sex. That's determined, obviously, by the male chromosome who has either the X or the Y, which has already been mentioned. And so that really is what we're talking about in terms of human sexuality, and certainly gender issue. It is, as the doctor has said, it's a social construct. Everything that I have read on this, other than what comes out of DMS-5 and their sort of very rather elaborate definition of gender, they say it's used to denote the public lived role as boy or girl, man or woman, but in contrast to certain social constructionist theories. I mean, they get into some pretty confusing things, but it is a social construct, and it can mean whatever you want it to mean. And so, but this is where people are right now in the PC world. And it certainly fits into what I've been really focusing on is sort of the issue of the pursuit of happiness, well, how that plays into this. Because I don't think it's too accurate to get into therapy versus treatment or therapy versus enhancement issues. Those tend to blur everything. And I know the doctors would agree with that. So this whole area of sex biblically is defined. Gender is not defined biblically. And so what happens is that we get into the whole issue of, in philosophy and what it's mentioned before, is the whole issue of Gnostic view of the body, a very materialistic view. So that's kind of, I agree, it's just it's very straightforward in the scriptures what sex means.
So sex is clearly defined, and there are a few exceptions, which, as Dr. Orient pointed out, that when there are some extreme circumstances, that can create confusion. But for the most part, it's pretty clearly defined. If you have a Y chromosome, you're a male. If you do not, you're a female. The yes. Gender is then is a social construct. When did or where did what's the history of the term transgender? How far back does this history go, Dr. Critella?
As I said, the first time gender and also the word transgender was used went back to Virginia Prince, who was a cross-dressing male, I believe, in the 1950s. What I may be misrecalling that date, mm-hmm. but the best history of the term is found actually in the book called Gender Hurts. It came out in 2014, and it is written by an academic feminist. Her name is Sheila Jeffries, and she gives an extensive history of the term. So it started definitely prior to the 1960s, but did not truly take off until queer theory hit academia in the 1990s. And now it's gotten to the point where transgender does not mean only men who have taken hormones and had surgery to look like women, or women who have taken hormones and surgery to look like men. It can just mean someone who wakes up one day and, you know, I'm not sure what I am. And, or it may be a person who says, I feel like a woman today, and then a month later might decide they feel like a man. It's really become quite nebulous, and she documents this with specific historic references in her book, Gender Hurts.
Dr. Weiss, what do you know about the history of this term transgender?
Well, actually, I found it going back into the 40s with a book called Sexology. Harry Benjamin and other people. I agree with the doctor on. It's really hard to determine who, in my opinion, who really originated this term. From my perspective, I guess I'm not too concerned about who was the person that coined the phrase. From a historical viewpoint, I suppose that's important. Surgeries that went for transgenders goes way back into the early 1900s, because, you know, when you get into Christine Jorgensen, you know, certainly more recently Bruce Jenner, and what we're running into with some of the other issues that come from this, two of the books I have found, which are pretty, and the doctors may be aware of these, by Susan Stryker, the Transgender Studies Reader, which are about 700 pages apiece. And they go through what the doctors have talked about in terms of historical issues. There's a Transgender Studies Reader 1 and 2, published by Routledge, and each of them have about 50 authors apiece. And they go through all of the historical context that have been discussed already, how people view this. And really, quite interestingly, they're all pretty honest dealing with radical feminism. And its view of what I call, I guess you might say, menu hermeneutics, where they pick and choose what they want out of the Bible to justify what they're doing. I'm not saying that there are some people who don't have struggles with this, which we can talk about later, and they clearly do, especially in prepubescent issues and adolescence, which the doctors are more tuned in on that than I am. But I think transgender studies it has a long, long history. I mean, I can even find resources back into the late 1800s where they talk about these issues in terms of people dressing. I mean, especially women who served in the military, and they didn't know if they were men or women, and they passed as men. In fact, they were women. So at any rate, I really don't have my fingertips on the person or persons who originated the term, but I do know that the history of this whole complex issue really is a century, at least one century old.
Dr. Orient, where does the issue of gender and sex and even the term transgender, does it fit in the education, preparation, the formation of a physician today? Is this a part of the education and the formation of a physician today?
Well, I am working on preparing the fifth edition of Sapiris, Art and Science of Bedside Diagnosis. And I can tell you the previous four editions had no mention of this, really. The history may go back a long time. My awareness of it is really quite recent. I mean, there have been these individual cases, and then I had been aware of homosexual men who were female impersonators, but I don't think they ever really thought they were female. I thought they just enjoyed cross-dressing. So before, it was an individual type of problem, but now it has just rocketed into a point of political contention, and it's probably very dangerous to a physician to even express any concerns about the validity of the concept. So I'm having a real struggle with how to present this even in the educational process of medical students. It is just really tough. And I think part of the problem is just our whole society is so focused on sexuality. People no longer think of themselves as a physician or a mother or an architect or a contractor. They spend their whole life worrying about what sex they are or what gender they are. And it just seems to me this is just pathological, because it takes the focus off what's really important in life and puts it on this I think, psychopathological concept.
Dr. Curtella, what have we done by creating this social construct of transgender? How has this affected children and then later in life as well?
Well, maybe a good place to start is what's normal. Mm-hmm. What happens to children in terms of attaching and attaching to their mothers and fathers, and coming to identify themselves as a boy or a girl? Because really, that's what we're talking about. And a baby is born, and they've been living within their mother's womb for 9 months already, and we have proof of psychological and emotional, as well as physiological bonding that goes on between a baby and his or her mother in the womb. And let's say it's a little girl. The amount of emotional, psychological, and even at the root of brain chemistry, the bonding that takes place between that baby and the mother every time the mother holds the baby, and most especially while breastfeeding, it's just tremendous. And that first human relationship of mother and child is so critical and beautiful. An infant who has a very warm, loving, and secure attachment to the mother is going to have an easier time, particularly, let's say it's a little girl, as she grows within the first 3 years of life, she will come to recognize, oh, I'm like mommy. And mm-hmm. typically that's what happens by the age of three. The majority of children will recognize that either they are like mommy, they are girls, or if they have that secure, the more secure their attachment is to their mother, who ideally is married to the child's father, they are more securely attached to mom. They will be more secure also in their relationship with their father and in being with others.
Hold on to that thought. We need to take a quick break. When we come back from that break, we'll continue our discussion and how this foundation is built for identity in children. You're listening to Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO. We're talking with Drs. Cretella, Dr. Orient, and Dr. Weiss today on this issue, this transgender issue. We'll be right back right after this break.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration in action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
When euthanasia was legalized in Holland, they claimed strict safeguards would prevent patients from being killed against their will. After recently legalizing euthanasia of children, they're now euthanizing demented patients such as Alzheimer's. The patient must have signed an advance directive, but it could have been signed years ago, and there's no effort to see if the person has changed their mind. It's legal even if the person can't say yes or no to euthanasia. The reason they've sunk to this new low is because some so-called doctors are already doing it. If doctors break the law, officials respond by changing the law, so the lawbreakers are now legal. Their claims of strict safeguards would be laughable if the result wasn't so tragic. It's echoes of Nazi Germany.
Follow us on Twitter at Life Issues USA and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Hi, I'm Grace Kane, a junior at Lutheran High School South in St. Louis. Every day, I can grow in my faith with Christian faculty and other young believers. Together, we grow in the challenging academic environment at Lutheran South. Thanks to my school, I'm ready to not just go to college, but excel in college and throughout the rest of my life. Have you checked out Lutheran schools lately? Learn more at lhssstl.org. That's lhssstl.org.
Do you know how your savings and investments are being used by your commercial financial institution? Hi, this is Rich Robertson, President and CEO of the Lutheran Church Extension Fund. We all need to be comfortable with how our money is being used. Recent market jumps really brought that back home for many of us. That's why investing with LCEF is so attractive for so many LCMS members and organizations. Visit lcef.org or call us at 800-843-5233.
Hi, this is President Matthew Harrison. It's with a thankful heart that I share my gratitude to all of you who so faithfully serve the Lord as volunteers within the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We are so blessed by your generous and gifted spirit, and we are uplifted by your volunteer service to make known the love of Christ. May God bless and fortify you in your service. May your service bring you joy.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. We are discussing the issue of transgender youth, transgender children, and today we're talking with Dr. Michelle Cretella, Dr. Jane Orient, and Dr. Bob Weiss on this issue. Before we went to break, Dr. Cretella, you were talking about the development, understanding this proper foundation for the development of identity, especially when it comes to sex and gender in children.
Right, and so just to recap, what the three of us have really said is that no one is born transgender, okay? No one is born with an awareness of being female or male. And what is key to developing that awareness, okay, you are born either with a Y chromosome or without. You're born with a Y chromosome, you're a boy. Without a Y chromosome, you're a girl. That's how you are born. Biology is basically, when it comes to sex, that's who and what you are. Okay, that's biology. But this awareness develops, and it develops in accordance with a secure, loving attachment, first and foremost, to the mother. And with that secure attachment to the mother, over the first 3 years, that enables a girl to generally recognize subconsciously and consciously, I'm like mommy. And similarly for a boy, that secure attachment allows him to recognize he's different from mommy in certain ways. And ideally, mom and dad are married and they have a good relationship and dad is involved with the children as well. The little boys will identify with daddy and the girls, again, more so with mommy. So normally that identity as either a boy or a girl is formed by age 3. It's also normal to see some children kind of showing interest in opposite sex toys or opposite clothing or costumes or whatnot. It could just be a passing phase at that age.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that something's wrong. And I'll just, as an example, we had 3 boys before we had our daughter. The house was filled with cars and trucks. And for the longest time, she really wasn't too interested in the few dolls that she had been given. But what was interesting is when she played with those little cars and trucks, and this is between the ages of, let's say, 3 and 5, she was making stories up with them. So you will see girls tend to be more relational. So whereas the boys are going brum, brum, and crashing their cars around and so forth, you could still see these sex differences in how she played with the toys. And I think if parents were to ask me, you know, what do we do if we see boys playing, trying to dress up like a princess, or girls being rough and tumble, I would say you don't have to be punitive, but let's take the boy who wants to dress up like a princess. Maybe he's got a bunch of sisters. And you might say, oh, hey, you know what? Boy, come over here. Let's dress you up like a prince. Boys are princes. As long as you are affirming of them as boys, you want to be affirming of them as boys, and similarly, girls affirming of their femininity, affirming of boys' masculinity, it does not necessarily mean that, oh my gosh, something is wrong.
So by constructing this term transgender, then we lay aside that building of that foundation of identity.
Yeah, it's a lie, really. It's implying that you know, just because you have boy parts doesn't mean you're a boy, and that's a lie. You know, there's no science behind this belief that you can be born in the wrong body. That is not science. That is ideology. So you're constructing this lie. You're causing confusion among children and among parents. And that's just wrong, because what happens from there, see, again, this awareness is a process. It starts from certainly from birth, if not before. That bonding with the mother starts before birth. And again, that secure attachment, that can be derailed by any number of things, and not even serious trauma. It can just be derailed even by perceptions of the child. And so if you get a child who is confused, and instead of trying to work with the family and the child to figure out the cause of that confusion, you advise the family to, oh, yes, you know what? Let Johnny dress as a princess, and yes, let him grow his hair, and make everybody around him call him she and a new name and so forth. Well, you're reinforcing that child's confused thinking, and you're leading them down the road to being terrified of their own healthy body. And this is what we're seeing with these children who they're confused, they're going to so-called gender clinics. The therapists are encouraging parents and school systems to treat these little boys as though they're girls, refer to them as girls. And now, as the boys are approaching puberty, a normal, healthy process, they are terrified because they don't want to look like a boy. They want to keep pretending that they're a girl. And so what starts out as confused thinking that could have been treated with some, you know, family therapy, it turns into confused thinking that is going to become a delusion at some point. And what I and many other physicians are absolutely appalled at is that these children are led down this road and then told, and the parents told, well, now we need to stop the puberty. We need to arrest it. We need to put them on puberty blockers. Now, wait a minute. Puberty is a normal, healthy process. This is a child who is physically healthy. Why am I stopping their puberty? But by definition, I'm giving them a disease. Okay, the absence of puberty is a disorder. So now I'm giving them, and I'm giving them hormones to stop puberty, hormones that arrest the child's growth, hormones that at least temporarily make the child infertile. And the argument, which again has no science behind it, goes, well, we need to give these children more time to decide whether they're boys or girls. Okay, you know what? Now, wait a minute. You've been allowing them and encouraging them to believe they are the opposite sex, and now you're going to arrest their puberty. What do you think is going to happen during that time? You think all of a sudden they're going to come back to reality and accept their biological sex? You know, this is sick. This is just absolutely wrong, what is being done to these children.
Dr. Orient, I'd like to hear your perspective on, especially on the science of what science says about the development of this identity when it comes to sex and gender in children. And when we introduce this concept of transgender, what does that mean? Does that create confusion?
Oh, absolutely. I agree with what Dr. Cretella had to say, that if we have a child who is a little confused or unhappy, it isn't right to give him a major serious disease that's going to affect the rest of his life. Most children who have these points of confusion get over them. And so the initial confusion has a remedy. Or the children outgrow it. But once you start to give them hormones or worst of all, do surgery on them, what you're doing is not reversible. And it has long-term effects on their health and keeps them from ever really recovering their ability to be a normal man or normal woman.
Dr. Weiss, any thoughts on this development of identity in children?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this goes back to what I think it was Dr. Cretella, maybe Orient, had mentioned about Virginia Prince's view of all of this stuff, where she gets into, I think if she were, I don't know if she's still alive, but I know she'd be about probably about 104 years old by now. But she just simply believes that gender is always becoming a boy or a girl, a man or a woman. And so you can't change the sex, obviously, what they're saying, but you can change the gender. And this is what the doctors are talking about. I always tell the students to stick to your vocation. And since I'm not a physician, I want to stick to my vocation. Because having taught in medicine doesn't make me a physician. But I do think that this plays into the whole issue, and I do want to sort of bring this out of Gnosticism that must disconnect, and this is what I hear the physicians talking about in a theological purview. You must disconnect the personhood from sexuality, and that is, it must argue that an individual's biological sex is not the central feature of one's existence as a person. Which Dr. Curtello is saying, this is essentially the Gnostic position, which the sexual identity of a person is distinct from the sexual identity of the body, in which the person basically is out of spirit, of soul, it's sort of in prison. So a materialistic view of the body means, look, you can change it. And so thus the sexual identity of the body can be ignored, it can be denied, to conform to this person's higher self-understanding. And I think this, from a biblical viewpoint, this is the direct biblical and historic challenge that we face as human beings, which are a body and a soul, you know, as an embodied person. So I do see what they're saying from a Gnostic viewpoint, not only that, but I also see that the pursuit of happy souls is not simply, the ultimately our desire for happiness, but it's for the fulfillment of our aspirations and the flourishing of our lives, which seems to be more connected to the parents seeking to keep their children happy. That leads to what I perceive to be, they think that they're going to have a better child and do things differently. So I think this, the use of puberty blockers, what I would call, you know, biotechnology in the pursuit of happiness. I think the issue of happiness really is part of the problem here, as opposed to what parents really need to be doing. And this is where I think the doctors have hit the nail on the head here, and that is to get into some family therapy. But there are many people in this area, in this field, that say, nah, that's not what you do. You sort of let them play this role out. You know, when I grew up, and I think, I don't know how old the doctors are, but we used to call people that, girls that got into boy sorts of things, tomboys. Mm. You know, so that's kind of how I'm looking at this from a theological viewpoint.
Dr. Curtello, what can we do for parents of a child who expresses concern or confusion about their gender? As what can we do to help parents? What do parents need to know? And you started to express this, or to explain this earlier. You know, when a child chooses toys or something like that are generally associated with the opposite sex. What do you do as a pediatrician for parents, and what can we help our parents who are listening today?
Right. Again, the vast majority of children are going to be developing in accordance with their biology, in the sense most biological girls are going to identify with their moms, and they're going to identify themselves as girls. So most parents who have questions about this, who would come to me, were really just dealing with sort of some of the sibling issues that I described before. If you have a daughter who's born first and a son second, and there are more girl toys around, you know, the son starts crawling and so forth, it's normal for siblings to get into each other's toys and play. As long as there is good involvement of the father with sons, affirmation of the son's boyhood, you're going to be okay. In general, I do not recommend, you know, if a family comes to me, and this may have happened once, where the son who wanted to dress up as a princess, I do discourage cross-dressing. But again, it does not have to be punitive, like spanking or yelling or so forth, but more of a redirection and a firm dressing up like a fireman, the prince, or just affirmative roles. A lot of this is about role modeling. I think that speaks to it most of all. I can give you an example of maybe two examples where the awareness, the child's awareness or identity was thrown off. And in one case, it was really, you know, the parents didn't do anything, quote unquote, wrong. And oftentimes, this could be the situation. It's just the family dynamics, through no one's fault, is just skewed. It was a family who had a 3-year-old son, and then had a daughter, and the baby girl had health issues. So both parents, understandably, were putting more attention and time, spending more time with the little girl. They had to. And for whatever reason, this little boy, as between the ages of 3 and 5, sort of internalized that as, mommy and daddy would love me more if I were a girl. Hmm. Now, this only came out through months and months and months of therapy with this family. But I throw it out there just because, you know, the psychology, the subconscious is very unique, and not every little boy who has a sister with health problems would react that way. But for the individual child who may be struggling with this, it could be something like that. Now, on the other hand, I am aware of a grown man who did transition into appear to be the other sex, and he now traces it directly to a traumatic childhood. He's in his 60s now, and he told me confidentially, he said, when I was growing up, he had 3 sisters, and his mother struggled with depression, among other things, and routinely told him, I wish I had aborted you, or you should have been a girl like your sisters. So some cases, yes, there's definitely abuse that can cause this sexual confusion. And in other cases, it's just a matter of innocent circumstances in which the child's perception of themselves or the situation is thrown off.
Dr. Orient, when it comes to this issue of development and children and the identity, and a family comes to you as a physician with questions, concerns, anything you would add to what Dr. Cotella has shared with us?
Not really, except to say that we shouldn't be stuck with these sex stereotypes. There are girls who are interested in cars, mm-hmm. and they're still girls, and they're not confused about being girls, and they grow up to be good mothers. So I think we need to just consider there are individual differences, and some girls are interested in some boy things, but I don't see it as a boy thing to be interested in cars, although, there may be statistically more interest among boys. So I don't think that we should panic and say, well, my little girl has a transgender problem just because she's playing with trucks.
Certainly, certainly. What, we only have a few minutes left, but I want to talk about the, current quote-unquote treatments. I think, Dr. Cotella, you mentioned the treatment hormone blockers for puberty in an individual, in a youth who's approaching puberty and facing a gender identity confusion. A lot of treatments. What are the risks with the treatments that so those who are in favor of this concept of this social construct of transgender, what are the risks that come with that? You mentioned earlier that there's danger in blocking these hormones because puberty is not a disease, but rather it's a sign of a physically healthy child.
A normal process. The medications that are used do arrest bone growth. And also, by blocking puberty, you're preventing the development of fertility in both boys and girls. Now, the physicians and therapists in favor of the puberty blockers basically argue that they want to prevent the kids from becoming suicidal, and that it's better to basically let them live out this fantasy by blocking their puberty temporarily, because if they live out the fantasy of being the opposite sex and like it during their teen years, we can take them off the puberty blockers and their bone growth will catch up and their fertility will return. And then they can choose the cross-sex hormones. So to me, you know, philosophically, there's a problem with blocking puberty because that is the normal healthy process. Mm. And you're taking these kids through a fantasy to the point where they are now going to choose cross-sex hormones, and those are the hormones that they will need to be on for a lifetime that will put them at risk for high blood pressure, for strokes, for cancer, and a host of other diseases. And P.S., we're now hearing more and more in the media the fact that once these children, adolescents, and then young adults continue to live out this lie as the opposite sex, they then want artificial reproductive technology so that they can have, quote-unquote, biological children.
We have less than a minute left. I think here the pressing question is, then if, as a parent, as a physician, introducing these measures, hormone blockers or whatever type of treatment it may be, that it leads to confusion, can lead to health risks, is that not then abuse?
I would call it so. I would call it institutionalized abuse, but institutional in the sense it's being pushed by medical professionals, mental health professionals, as well as academic/educational, because you're getting this ideology also at the level of public schools, as young as kindergarten in public schools that have comprehensive sex education and anti-bullying policies.
Well, we are all out of time. Definitely a tough topic and certainly more to be said about it. Dr. Michelle Cortella, President of the American College of Pediatricians, thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you.
Dr. Jane Orient, Executive Director of the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you.
And the Reverend Dr. Bob Weiss, Concordia Seminary St. Louis Professor of Practical Theology, thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you very much.
Well, coming up in just a little bit, Thy Strong Word with Pastor Whedon right here on Worldwide KFUO.
Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.